This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. A lot of academic research was paid for with public funding, but public access is often restricted by expensive paywalls. Meanwhile, some academic publishing companies have higher profit margins than companies like Walmart, Google, and Apple. But there is a movement underway that could turn the tide. A growing number of scholars are pushing for open access to academic research. Jason Schmidt is a filmmaker working on a documentary on that very subject. It's called Paywall, The Business of Scholarship. Jason, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Frank, thanks for having me.
In just a minute, we're going to talk to Jamie Boyle, too. He's a professor of law at Duke University and co-founded the Center for the Study and the Public Domain. But, Jason, I want to start with you about this documentary that you've done. You interviewed 70 people for the documentary. Anybody against open access?
Oh, yeah. There's a large movement against open access. There's a handful of publishers that have a prerogative to maintain the existing status quo as long as possible because it's the most profitable stream going in a capitalistic society because there's no inputs. Nobody pays to create. When you create an iPhone, somebody has to dig in the earth and pull up kind of the core elements that create that phone, and that there's cost associated with that. Research is given to these large publishers for free by researchers and scientists and academics around the globe so that they can continue their career trajectory, get tenure, and it creates a very unfair playing field, an extremely, extremely lucrative one.
Well, but there are costs. They have to be published. There's paper. There's distribution. You have to get this thing out. You've got to get these citations linked. I mean, there's work involved in there, and people get paid, right?
There is work involved, but that work that you're referencing is really kind of a pre-internet heavy cost load of making those documents and publishing those journals and binding them and sending them. We live in a very different internet economy now where once that research is created and once that research is peer-reviewed, it is very, very cost-effective to send that research around the globe. There's next to zero cost of disseminating it. There's always cost with peer review. There's always cost with the actual editorial process and graphics, but it's a significantly less cost than what was accounted for decades prior.
Jamie Boyle, law professor at Duke, co-founder of the Center for the Study of the Public Domain. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Frank.
You're an expert in the public domain. You just heard Jason say, look, we can do this stuff virtually free now. I mean, there's some vetting and checking and all that costs money, but we can just get it out there. So why don't we?
That's just a wonderful question. I think most of your listeners will go, well, wait a minute. The researchers are paid to write articles and indeed are fired if they don't. Most of the research is funded by the federal government. The editors, many of the editors, actually do the peer reviewing for free. And the results of all of this research are of incredible benefit both to the citizens who paid for it and to other scientists. So why on earth haven't we fixed that? And that's a great question. It was only 10 years ago that NIH implemented an open access mandate, and gradually we are sort of lurching towards open access, although, as Jason noted, there's a strong movement against it. But frankly, and I mean this is something to pursue perhaps, things are, I think, even worse than Jason suggested. The Internet was founded to make scientific collaboration possible. The Internet works great for music. It works great for buying books. It works great for finding hotels and restaurants. It works great for porn, I'm told. But it does not work properly for scientific literature, the very thing that it was founded to help enable.
Well, I'm going to ask it again and in a different way. Just why not? Jamie, you publish a paper on the public domain. Just get it out there. Jamie.com, and there's my paper. Right. And it's paid for by the publisher. It's not like you put a lot of money into this. In fact, you got paid to make it. So put it out there.
Yes. So you could do that, but you probably wouldn't get tenure because your department would look at you and say, well, did you publish in a reputable journal? So inside of academia, we have to help fix the incentives. Slowly, people are realizing that if they publish in open access journals, they actually have a higher so-called impact factor, namely more eyeballs are reading their article and that their articles are more widely cited. And tenure committees are slowly coming around to that. So people can do this. There's something called a green road to open access publishing, basically requiring self-archiving. And those are, you know, useful mechanisms. But what we have to do is move towards this as just a requirement for every kind of grant to do research, that not just the articles, but the data on which the articles are available be made available to everyone. And the thing about that, and this I think is, we focus just on access by the Mark One eyeball, you know, that Frank Statio will be able to read it without paying, you know, $37,000 to read Elsevier. But actually, even more important is to give computers access to that. When you search for a restaurant in Durham, you just assume you'll see not just where the restaurant is, when it's busiest, because Google has figured that out from who's going there. You'll get all these reviews. Everything is cross-linked and integrated, and you take that for granted. That doesn't exist when this research sits behind paywalls. And if we could make this work for science by working on all of the incentives, from publishing on the one hand, to the authors, educating them, to the departments, to the funders, then we could really, I think, achieve a much greater rate of scientific progress.
Well, let me put this one to Jason. It seems to me that Jamie did put his finger on at least one value, which is, I mean, if tenure depends on being published in these reputed journals, then the value is being published in the reputed. What is it about the reputation? Do they bring that? And is there some value? That otherwise, if everybody and their brother published whatever they wanted on the internet, I would have a hard time knowing what's good and what's not. So if I go to the reputed journal and pay the $37,000 a year, whatever it is, I know it's good stuff. Isn't there value in that? And shouldn't you get paid for that?
Sure, there's value in that. Kind of what Jamie was alluding to with impact factor, I think even needs to really be unpacked more. The impact factor drives society to choose a few BMW and Rolls-Royce outlets, and there's some serious implications with that. Those Rolls-Royce sort of outlets that have high impact factor, which we know impact factor is actually a flawed mechanism, even when their founder has said that it should not be used in the way it's currently being used. It's a really easy to understand and quantify variable, and it looks scientific. There's three decimal points, and you can really understand, like, it's a quantitative, easy to understand measure, and that drives emphasis. So much so that if you were to publish in a top journals, top impact factor journals, some call them these CNS diseases, sort of the Cell, Nature, and Science. Those are all high impact factor, high prestige journals. If you're a Chinese researcher and publish in one of those journals, you get a large fraction of your salary as a year-end bonus because of that prestige journal. Now, the implication is, though, that most people around the globe can't get access. And I've talked to a lot of them. And, you know, I talked to a Nepal-based medical doctor, a Nigerian medical doctor, and they both said that they cannot get access to treat their patients to the most current research because it's locked behind a paywall, because it's a privileged, sort of scarcity-driven, high-impact factor journal. And that's really something I think that society should be aware of, that we're not firing in all cylinders, and we're not allowing some of the best minds in our generation, which could be out in the, you know, the middle of, you know, Africa, to have this research and to take it further.
Is there a way, Jamie, to guarantee quality and validity of the research without through an open access process?
There is. There absolutely is. I mean, we've solved this. I mean, first of all, there are very, I agree with everything Jason said about impact factors as being a flawed mechanism and leading us to focus on just a few very high-end things. There are things we can do. First of all, there are very high impact factor, prestigious open access journals. I was associated for a while with the Public Library of Science. They have excellent high impact factor journals as well. Second, we can try other mechanisms. We should be experimenting. This is science, after all. Post-publication peer review is a really interesting idea. The largest scientific journal in the world, PLOS One, which if you've ever read Science Times, the New York Times, odds are that you are reading about a study published in PLOS One. PLOS One basically checks to see that you're doing science, Frank, not numerology or astrology, right? But it doesn't try and say, is this the very best science? Is Frank the very best researcher? Once you figure out it's science, then it goes up on the web. And then what happens is, what would you would expect with anything else, whether it's stuff on Amazon or whether it's a movie, whatever, people, scientists, start referring to it. And some of them say Statio's work is bunk. Some of them say Statio's work is great. They link to it. And you get a sense, you know, the crappy articles, go down, and the ones that are excellent rise. And as a result, what happens is you do get this different method. I'm not saying we should get rid of peer review. Peer review is a very valuable technique. I'm saying we should be experimenting with multiple ways of checking, validating, reviewing scientific research, but we should have one goal, which is the one Jason pointed out. There's 4 billion connected people on the planet, and some of them are smarter than the guy who did the initial research.
Well, and peer review doesn't depend on being published in a journal, right? First of all, the peers do it for free, and you can get peer review outside of the publication in that journal, isn't it? Can't you?
That's true. Yeah. What you don't know, what you need is a more transparent system. Mm-hmm. So whether it's the current peer review system or some kind of post-publication peer review system where you have groups of scientists upvoting or downvoting the material, what you need is to figure out how the quality of the research was validated. The more transparency and openness we have, the more we can figure out whether we want to rely on these mechanisms. And as a result, scientific reputations rise and fall. But I think the key thing first is you get access to the data, because if you want to decrease scientific fraud, having open access to everything the researcher did, that really helps. You get access to the material so that lots of eyes looking at it. The more smart people looking at my research, the more chance it'll be they'll figure out if I'm a cheat or if I'm just a lousy scientist. And then you get more mechanisms, social mechanisms for review. And that's what Jason's point is so valid, which is we want the whole world, because maybe the guy who's going to figure out how to cure your granny's arthritis is in Nigeria. Like, you want that person to be looking at the article that was published in Science or Nature.
Yeah, not only are the people in those other parts of the world or don't have access to research that may have been done here, but interestingly enough, sometimes research that's done in those parts of the world about people who live in what we would call developing countries, the research, you know, the researchers come from the U.S., they parachute in, they do the research, they go back and publish, and the folks who were there upon whom they've done the research don't get to read it.
Yeah,
that's... Sorry, Jason, please.
No, that 40% of what's published in the New England Journal of Medicine was created and researched within 150-mile perimeter of that of Boston. Researching is really an insider's game. And, you know, unfortunately for that, it creates haves and have-nots. And that's not, you know, that's not globally empowering. That's not crowd-accelerated innovation. And I do think that there was a great journal example. It was Lingua. It was Lingua is an Elsevier-owned journal. You know, Elsevier is the top publisher on planet Earth. And the whole editorial board in 2015 met sort of under the radar of Elsevier and said, if we all the editors, which that's the actual journal, the quality of a journal is the editors, the peer review, and it's not the publisher. So all the editors met and said, you know, we could take everything we have and we could take it to open access and we could leave Elsevier and we could create an open access derivative. So all the editors, the 30 of them, led by Johan Rorick of Amsterdam, said, yes, let's do that. So in 2016, they flipped their Lingua journal, which was Elsevier, to an open access equivalent called Glossa. And now it has, again, sort of that same has exactly the same credibility, the exact same peer review, but now it's an open access derivative. And there's not that many cases, but the cases and the journals that are considering this are it's a growing number. And I think there's, you know, some sort of, you know, kind of takeaway of perhaps, you know, positive growth in this.
Well, why aren't there more? Jamie, let me ask you this question. You know, Elsevier, you talked about them. We actually asked them. They declined to be on the program, but they did send us some data. And interestingly enough, the data they sent in their defense, I have to read it here because that's a company that publishes 17%. One company publishes 17% of all the articles, the 2.5 million that are published every year. The top 4 publishers account for 40% of the market.
That's right.
And the fact is that there are only 35 companies on the S&P 500 whose profits are higher than that company. So here's my question. And they charge universities a lot for it. So, Jamie, let me ask you, why don't more universities say, we're not doing that? We're going to create our own open access. It's cheaper and we can guarantee its quality.
Well,
are they moving toward it?
I think they are. I mean, initially universities are driven by the cost because they see how much they're paying. They're focused more on the cost to them, not so much on the cost to the entire world, which I think Jason is rightly putting his finger on. Duke pays an enormous amount of money to get access to many Reed Elsevier journals. But by doing so, the universities who participate in this system are basically agreeing to the maintenance of an ecology and infrastructure which denies all of the people who don't have the Duke IP address, the Duke internet address, access. So, and the really frustrating thing is this is, you know, comparatively cheap. Yes, Reed Elsevier makes a vast amount of money, super competitive profits, which should lead you to wonder whether or not their business model is aligned with our social interests.
But $913 million in 2016.
Right. Let's not demonize.
That's pounds.
The point is, you know, this is a social problem, right? This is a problem that we need to work on. But actually, the cost of fixing it, when you think of all of the terrible problems we have around the world, the cost of fixing this would be relatively trivial. We're talking a rounding error in the NIH overall research budget. What you've got to do is get scientists, get universities, get funders, get patients' advocates, get doctors themselves realizing what their interests are, and it's that initial movement cost, the coordination of getting an entire ecosystem, which is frankly suboptimal. It's just not it's not serving our social interests. And what we've got to do is move further and faster. I'm glad to say that is happening. We have lots of open access journals. Even the for-profit publishers allow people to buy open access. And I love them making money. That's great. I just want them to make money in a way that is serving the social good.
I want to thank you both for being on our program. Jamie Boyle, co-founder of the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School and a law professor, and a founding board member of the Creative Commons. Thank you for being on the show, Jamie.
It was great to be here.
Jason Schmidt, the producer of the documentary Paywall, The Business of Scholarship, which is about open access movement, the movement in academic publishing. Jason, thank you so much.
Frank, thanks for your time.
And you can find out more about all of this at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Robert Kinlaw, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.